you know, I mean, this question you talk about, but what is this resistance?
It is really of the desire, the herd desire to, that is always challenged by difference. And now one of the challenges, I think, implicit challenge by just being present to yourself and showing that that difference is in you. Or perhaps it doesn't have necessarily happen even at a very dramatic kind of level. If, for example, you're quite an emotional person and you cry easily. Now, if you're in a Latin American country, that would not be a problem. Okay, that would be, you know, treated as normal and okay and lovely, and, you know. If, however, you're brought up in the British Isles, generally speaking, and you cry easily, you're too emotional, too sensitive, need to toughen up. I have a real memory from my own childhood. I used to cry all the time as a kid, much more easily than I now do. And and I was, so inverted commas, a sensitive child, which is not a compliment, like at all. You know, so but I have this image, silly image. But it was a critical image. I had this huge balloon which I loved. Beautiful big balloon. It was like a Zeppelin. It was a really lovely. And my Zeppelin burst. And I was feeling very sad that my Zeppelin had burst. And I was about to I was about to just do my normal, ordinary thing and cry and be sad because my Zeppelin had burst. But I remembered that good boys don't cry. And I don't know quite how I did it, but it was like I sort of squeezed something inside me. Mm-hmm. So the tears were somewhere squeezed back. And then I went and told them, and I was praised for being a good boy and not crying. And I remember feeling, I was still sad, but I'd been a good boy. And I'd set up a conflict, and of course I'd set up a conflict inside myself, of course, because I just had wanted to cry with my beautiful balloon, as though I did. Now a little bit of bubba on the end of the string. And I think that's the repeated impact on us when we're small. Which is different from, if you like, balanced socialization. Because obviously we, you know, as kids, as small people, we have to learn to get on with others. In a certain way, we have to learn how our anwa interacts with the anwa of others. And that is important. And so that we're not just the center of the world, and we can behave as we like. But there are these very powerful cultural imperatives that are not about that, that aren't about socialization, aren't about treating the other as you would yourself. They are about making you a particular shape that fits within the particular culture. Mm. And one of the things about British culture in particular is sensitivity is not prized. Sensitivity, emotionality is regarded as wrong. Stiff upper lip, absolutely right. You know, kind of don't be emotional, don't be, you know, one of the things that was a challenge to me in Israel was how expressively angry everybody is in Israel. Because we don't do it. I mean, our preferred form of anger in our country is passive anger and nastiness from behind, really. But charm to your face while sliding the knife into the kidneys from behind in the same moment you're smiling in somebody's face. Israelis scream and shout at each other and then they're okay. Palestinians scream and shout at each other and then they're okay. So similar, these people. Anyway, we'll go there. So So what we learn, in a sense, is that our natural expression, our natural creativity, is somehow not okay. Now, one of the interesting things about Alan Garner that we were looking at just before lunch is his discovery, you know, that what he wants is to be a writer. And he's an interesting and unusual person because he decides that that's all he ever did do, all he ever did. I mean, he's, not because he was wealthy, he wasn't wealthy. I can't find a particular person. Oh, Alan Garner's still alive, yeah. Yeah, no, totally. I mean, he's quite old now, but he's...
He did have a bestseller with his first book, though.
He did.
He established his reputation really quickly.
He did, and that's what enabled him, in a sense, to be able to continue to do what he did. But he did have to decide to do, you know, just to do that, and to live in kind of poverty.
Did he have an idea that he had to express, or did he want to be a writer and then had to think of the idea? Well, I'll show you. It sounded like he didn't know what to write. Well, let me just find the right bit where he actually describes how he writes.
What he says is this. My way of working is only one way, perhaps of no practical use to anyone else ever. Each book is the first, or ought to be. By this I mean any facility gained through experience should be outweighed by one's own self-critical development. The author should become harder to please, yet it does seem to be a pattern to all. It is this. An isolated idea or image presents itself spontaneously. It can come from anywhere. Something had happened, something seen, something heard. I react to it. Usually forget it, but it's filed in the unconscious mind. Later, and there's no saying when that will be, another idea or image appears unconnected to the first, and a spark flies between the two. They stand out clearly together, and I know they will form a book. The moment is involuntary and instantaneous, a moment of particularly sharp vision, but of no understanding. It is self-delusion, yet there is the sense that the book already exists, has always existed, and the task is not invention, but archaeological excavation. I must make the invisible object into something that others can see and interpret. That calls for research, to give the object shape and me a compass. The period varies. It's never been less than 2 years, and the most to date, 10 years. The spark struck by the primary idea is all that originality is or can be, and the point where hitherto pre-existing yet unconnected themes can converge and meet like the crossing of the poles of a teepee. It's where the book waits. When the research notes start to refer to each other, I know there's no more to be done but to let the story gestate. I become torpid and unintelligent. It's what I call the oh my god bit. I sleep for long periods. I stare into the fire, watching the pattern of flames, waiting. I'm not safe to take a sheep down a lane. Yet I've come to recognize that this is the time when the book is being written by the unconscious. It has switched my brains off so they don't get in the way. Then with a jolt of slipping from a curbstone, I see things happening and hear people talking in the theater of the head, and I write it down.
I always have little idea of what a story is about, and it feels like I make it up as I go along, although I do not. But there is no conscious plot or structure. I am a spectator. I watch. The sensation is not so much of an epiphany, but the convecting images, the research, the connections, the dreaming, the years of staring into the fire, meld to form a compost, to grow the story. It feels that I'm not in control, though I am, through the unconscious. It is an organic richness of emotion, uncontaminated by any message, social concern, sermon, dogma, or agenda. If it's anywhere near right, each reading should produce a different creative response in the reader, who will see things that I did not. Over more than half a century, I've developed the argument that creativity takes place in the unconscious, which is to beg the question of its existence, but it works for me, and that's what counts. The conscious intellect, which I was educated to venerate and do not despise, is a fine analyst, but now is not its time. When the words are flowing, I am the conductor, not the source, a piece of copper wire, not the generator. Spark, curbstone, gestation, teepee, theatre, spectator, archaeology, compost, copper wire. How many metaphors have I used trying to explain what I do not understand? It is absurd, but is it? If creativity is the product of the unconscious, as it appears to be with me, then since I am the instrument of the work, I am subordinate to it and cannot interpret it. I cannot say what it means, even if I want to. I've done my best by giving it form, translating it, and must leave interpretation to others and to the future. And in a way, that's really what he's describing here. He's really describing that same process that we've been looking at around Anoki and Anwa. Now he's applying it, of course, to the particular production of a book. But it's about any of our creative acts. And he just describes that beautifully, I think. It also describes exactly so. So also it describes Tolkien's process, right? So if we put that, so he's describing his own process, but it's very close to what Tolkien describes. So when Tolkien writes The Hobbit, in a hole there lived a hobbit, he has no idea what a hobbit is, and it's by allowing himself to discover that, and his whole legendarium, in lots of ways, is full of all kinds of... Part of the reason for Tolkien's larger legendarium is quite difficult is it's all things he's written down, like things he's discovered, that there is an organic unity underneath them. But they don't logically meet together very often, sometimes. And they're... And it's sort of interesting, and it's why I think it's interesting to juxtapose Alan Garner with J.R.R. Tolkien, because their output is couldn't be more different. Because Tolkien is prolix; he creates this huge world, this cosmology. The sort of Garner drilled down, producing shorter and shorter books, more and more intense experiences. Yet they're both somehow working with the same deep down process.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking of the meditation, that if you go into the spiral or out through the spiral, they both take you to the same place.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Now that's why this image is a really important image in looking at this. Right, so this combination of the spiral and the straight, are you spiraling inward, but you're also maybe spiraling outwards at the same time. And there is this juxtaposition of opposites that are held in balance. So that sense of entering into Anoki, entering into I amness, and that I amness being a moving shape that brings us into relationship, that brings us back to ourselves in a continual kind of conversation with the world. No, what Alan Garner does in that very, he does refer to his creative process, but obliquely in his letters sometimes. It's a different nature of the two men, the different nature of their animus. So Tolkien doesn't really talk personally except in his letters sometimes. In his essay on fairy stories, you get a much more of a sense of some of his thinking around this. But it's still not isn't quite as personal as when Alan Garner explained, well, this is exactly what I do. Because their animals are different, right? Because their nature is different. They're both, in a way, describing kind of similar kind of territory. And, you know, they've both really been very concerned with the idea of elves and human beings. So the Weird Stone of Brisingamen, which is Alan Garner's first book, he takes these figures, the Colin and Susan, who are these, you know, Enid Blyton figures in that his first writing, and he brings them to Alderley Edge, and they come into relationship with one of the primary kind of legends of Alderley Edge, that is about a king sleeping under the hill, and they encounter a wizard figure that's very like Gandalf. And they encounter elves and dwarves and much in the way that, you know, we find in Tolkien's books. Although the you know, Garner's way of dealing with these figures is quite different.
Which book is that?
The Weird Stone of Brisingamen. I'm just waiting for my Kindle to jam itself. I'm just waiting for reload. So I'll read you the beginning of the.
The Wolf of Blossom.
Of the Weird Stone of Brisingamen, because it's really very good.
I was interested when you said, Dom, that about Tolkien, Warwick and all this sort of thing, Tolkien localised things, because of course Alan Garner particularly localises everything.
Oh, very much so, yeah, totally.
Is there any aspect of any of his books that haven't had a reference in a local paper, local history, folklore, or whatever?
No, completely.
I see he's a master bringing together a story to make new story.
Yes, exactly. So I read you the beginning, really, of Colin and Susan. This is actually the beginning of. So this book, The Weird Stone of Brisingamen, which is all about the legend of Brisingamen. So he begins the book this time by talking about the legend of Alderley. So rather than beginning with a kind of Enid Blyton, it would begin with this legend. At dawn, one still October day, in the long ago of the world, across the hill of Alderley, a family from Mobley was riding to Macclesfield Fair, so very local. The morning was dull but mild. Light mists bedimmed his way. The woods were hushed. The day promised fine. The farmer was in good spirits, and he let his horse, a milk-white mare, set her own pace, for he wanted her to arrive fresh for the market. A rich man would walk back to Mobley that night. So his mind in the town, while he was yet on the hill, the farmer drew near to the place known as Thieves' Hole, and there the horse stood still and would answer to neither spur nor rein. The spur and rein she understood, and her master's stern command, but the eyes that held her were stronger than all of these. In the middle of the path, where surely there had been no one, was an old man, tall, with long hair and beard. "You go to sell this mare," he said. "I come here to buy. What is your price?" But the farmer wished to sell only at the market, where he would have a choice of many offers. So he rudely bade the stranger quit the path and let him through,
for if he stayed longer he would be late to the fair. Then go your way, said the old man. None will buy, and I shall await you here at sunset. The next morning at moment he was gone, and the farmer could not tell how or where. The day was warm, and the tavern cool, and all who saw the mare agreed she was a splendid animal, the pride of Cheshire, a queen among horses, and everyone said there was no finer beast in the town, but no one offered to buy. A sour-eyed farmer rode out of Macclesfield at the end of the day. At Thieves' Hole the mare stopped, the stranger was there. Thinking it any price was now better than none, the farmer agreed to sell. How much will you give? He said. Enough. Now come with me. By Seven Firs and Golden Stone they went, to Stormy Point and Saddle Bowl, and they halted before a great rock embedded in the hillside. The old man lifted his staff and lightly touched the rock, and it split with a noise of thunder. At this the farmer toppled from his plunging horse and on his knees begged the other to have mercy on him and let him go his way unharmed. The horse would stay, he didn't want her, only spare his life, that was enough. The wizard, for such he was, commanded the farmer to rise. I promise you safe conduct, he said. Do not be afraid, for living wonders you shall see here. Beyond the rock stood a pair of iron gates. These the wizard opened and took the farmer and his horse down a narrow tunnel deep into the hill. A light, subdued but beautiful, marked their way. The passage ended, and they stepped into a cave, and there a wondrous sight met the farmer's eyes. 140 knights in silver armour, and by the side of all but one, a milk-white mare. Here they lie in enchanted sleep, said the wizard, till the day will come, and come it will, when England shall be in direst peril, and England's mothers weep. Then out of the hill these must ride, and in a battle thrice lost, thrice won, upon the plain, drive the enemy into the sea. The farmer, dumb with awe, turned with the wizard into a further cavern, and here mounds of gold and silver and precious stones lay strewn along the ground. Take what you can carry in payment for the horse. And when the farmer had crammed his pockets, ample as his lands, his shirt and his fists with jewels, the wizard hurried him up the long tunnel and thrust him out the gates. The farmer stumbled, the thunder rolled. He looked, there was only the rock above him. He was alone on the hill near Stormy Point. The broad full moon was up and it was night. And though in later years he tried to find the place, neither he nor any after him saw the iron gates again. Nell Beck swore she saw them once, but she was said to be mad. And when she died, they buried her under a hollow bank near Brindlow Wood in the field that bears her name to this day. I'll just read you just a few lines. So that's the legend, which is the basis of the whole book. Highmost Redmondhay. The guard knocked at the compartment as he went past. Wimslow, 15 minutes. Thank you, shouted Colin. Colin began to clear away the debris of the journey. Apple cores, orange peel, food wrappings, magazines, while Colin pulled down their luggage from the rack. And within 3 minutes, they were both poised on the edge of their seats, case in hand and Macintosh over one arm, caught like every traveller before us or since in that limbo of journey's end, where there is nothing to do, no time to relax. These last miles are the longest of all. The platform of Wimslow Station was thick with people, and more spilled off the train, but Colin and Susan had no difficulty in recognising Gautam Mossack among those waiting. As the tide of passengers broke round him and surged through the gates, leaving the children lonely at the far end of the platform, he waved his hand and came striding towards them. He was an oak of a man, not over tall, but solid as a crag, and barrelled with flesh, bone and muscle. His face was round and polished, blue eyes crinkled to the humour of his mouth. A tweed jacket strained across his back, and his legs curved like the timbers of an old house, were clad in breeches, which tucked into thick woolen stockings just above the swelling calves. A felt hat, old and formless, was on his head, and hobnailed boots struck sparks from the platform as he walked. "Hello, I'm thinking you might be Colin and Susan." His voice was gusty and high-pitched yet mellow, like an autumn gale. "That's right," said Colin, "and are you Mr. Mossack?" "I am, but we'll have none of your Mr. Mossack, if you please. Gouter's my name. Now come on, let's be having you. Bess is getting us some supper, and we're not home yet." He picked up their cases, and they made their way down the steps to the station yard, where there stood a green farm cart with high red wheels, and between the shafts was a white horse with shaggy mane and fetlock. "Hey up, scamps," said Gouter, as he heaved the cases into the back of the cart. A brindle lurcher, which had been asleep on a rug, stood and eyed the children warily while they climbed to the seat. Gouter took his seat placed between them, and away they drove under the station bridge on the last stage of their travels. They soon left the village behind and were riding down a tree-bordered lane between fields. They talked of this and that, and the children were gradually accepted by Scamp, who came and thrust his head onto the seat between Susan and Gouter. Then, "What on earth's that?" said Colin. "They had just rounded a corner. Before them, rising abruptly out of the fields a mile away, was a long-backed hill. It was high and sombre and black. On the extreme right-hand flank, outlined against the sky, were the towers and spires of big houses, showing among the trees, which covered much of the hill like a blanket. "Yon's the edge," said Gouter, 600 feet and 3 mile long. You'll have some grand times there, I can tell you. Folks think how Cheshire's flat as a pancake, and so it is for the most part, but nowhere we live." So, you can see how his thinking has developed, how his writing has developed, and they're very Eden. There's something of the Enid Blyton in the kids coming into the station. But what can get missed really is the strange archaicness of everything. This is a book written in the 60s. These are children of the 1960s. And so we begin with the myth of Alderley Edge. They come off the train station, and they're met by this quite archaic figure of Gouter Mossack, who isn't waiting for them in a car. And if we were back in the 40s or something, or the 30s, we'd understand, but it is the 60s. Who brings them into, who has this, his own horse, and a white mare that holds it, and a green cart, and he leads them away into not a main road but a byway, which leads them towards the edge. So already you're in mythic time. And you see where he is just following himself, following. And the great difference is, and that's why the description in Thousands and Films is very important, where he's not self-consciously trying to write a book for an audience. He's taken those two figures, and he's undergone the sort of process that he was describing, and something very different is coming out. And while he was writing this book, he was poor. He was living in a... He had a very, very... You know, he was just scraping by, living in poverty. He had no idea whether the book was going to be a success or not. Turns out to be a great success. But that's not something he knows when he's writing that. What he's doing is trusting that flow of creativity from inside himself. Now, what's important when we think about creativity, because our culture is geared into thinking books, paintings, fine sculpture, stuff like that, what we can miss is this whole idea of Anwar, that all the beings have creativity, and that creativity naturally arises from the place of being within us, and there are no key place within us.
And in a way, when he writes about his ancestors, you know, there's a woodworker, there's a mason, there's a, you know, and this wonderful phrase of his advice of his grandfather's, but if the other man can do it, let him. Don't imitate. Trust the particularity that arises out of your own being nature. Because however it is, even if it sounds the same as somebody else's, it will not be. Because it's coming out of your own particular being. Now, when people imitate, I think of the, you know, if you think of the many imitators of Tolkien, because part of what happens to Tolkien's writing is because it's so successful. There's a particular writer who I've never really read, so I hope I'm not doing a great disservice. I did try to read it and couldn't bear it. It's a man called Terry Brooks, who wrote something called the Shannara series, written about 20, you know, even 30 books, which are absolute, for me, imitations of Tolkien's writings. And I can never been able to read them. Now, because they're repetitious. They're repetitious because they're not coming out of something, I think, that is genuine Anwar. It's a sort of facsimile. It's an approximation of what the writer thinks will sell. And therefore, when we're doing anything that is purely imitative in our way, whatever it is, then it's even like cooking, right? So when you follow a recipe, nobody ever quite does the recipe in the same way as somebody else. Mm-hmm. Or we the pinches of things we put in, or the quantity we put in, or the length of time we cook something. It is how we do it. Our particular way of mashing potatoes. How much milk do you put in to mash potato? How much butter have you put butter in? How long do you mash it? Or even something as simple as that. It has its and the thing about anything that we do that connects to our being nature, and that our Anwa connects to, is infused with our own creativity, our own kind of energy and essence somewhere. That's why eating a meal from somebody who's been very angry while eating a meal is quite likely to upset your system, because the putting together a food while you're raging kind of conveys something into the food that then gets taken into the eating of the food.
I'm a chef, but on retreat, and he cooked these cookies, and he told us as a story. And everybody said these cookies are really great, and he always said, "Well, they're good, but they're not quite right. They're just not quite it." But everybody's saying how wonderful they were, and then eventually he realised that he was trying to imitate the cookies that he had from, I don't know, a mass-produced packet when he was a kid.
Ah.
And even though he was doing his own thing, they never felt quite right because they weren't.
Yes.
The thing he had originally, which was. Not good, actually.
Not good, no. So he was doing something better, yes.
So you've got that idol of it.
Well, it's the idol of the image. That's so again, we're back with the icon and the idol, aren't we? We're back with that way in which we can disregard our... So he was disregarding his genuine creativity, his genuine ability to produce something that was much better.
Back of it was there, undermining his creativity.
That's so interesting, that. No, it's true. It's a really interesting thing.
I keep thinking about how everything now it gets so, I don't know what the word is, but kind of like colonized by the algorithm. People's stuff gets mixed and they're constantly trying to get visibility and being original is like the new algorithm thing.
It's a bizarre thing, isn't it? Because being original is now genuinely unoriginal. Right? So being original has become a product, has become a, instead of being an aspect of being, it's become a thing that you should be.
So it's become an object rather than arising, rather manufactured object, rather than arising directly out of our subjectivity, out of our direct relationship with life.
You personalise your phone by having whichever colour case you want with it. That's your creativity.
I think that's what fascinated me so much about The Other Way is Essex. I'm pretty sure that each one, I mean, I don't know because I've not watched it, but I'm pretty sure that every one of those actors I saw in this trailer would think of themselves as being original and expressing their originality, and yet they look completely the same from outside. But I'm sure that they would believe that they were expressing themselves in a in an original way.
If they think they are, that's how
for them they are. Well, for them they are, but they're lost. But in a certain sense, you know, what is interesting then, okay, is that they, because the thing about genuine creativity is it's always different. No one cookie made by two different people is the same.
I was thinking about Carrie, The Only Way Is Essex, over lunch, and what you were saying about imagination. It's like the inability to imagine who they are or how they could be independent of the societal structure that shows them what they should be.
Yeah.
And that's, I think it speaks to that point, doesn't it, then?
Yeah.
There's this kind of the potential of true and within, because it feels like everything we are, everything we do, is from that place of Anwa in its essence.
Yeah.
But the form could be so manipulated.
Yeah.
By our own constructs, by the constructs of society.
Yeah.
That then it gets minimised, and we've lost the harmonics of the song. Then.
Yes, exactly. And
trying to sing the song that we think we should be singing.
Yeah.
But that place of no longer being able to imagine who we could be. It's something that kind of, I was trying to find that, or that template of that soul song that has been so overlaid with other people's concept of what that soul song is or what that Anwar is, that we can no longer imagine beyond that.
Well, no, and we need time and patience for that as well. I mean, I think Garner describes very well where he gets this image to set up a spark within him, and then he has to wait for that image to connect to another image, and then that forms a kind of a almost a circuit or a kind of a vortex around which then becomes the core of whatever is in there. But then that can take, well, in his case he's saying at the minimum time is 2 years before he, and in one case at least more than 10 years. So the, you know, so that listening, trusting, being able to distinguish between the that deep listening that connects us to the Anoki place, the I am place, and the energy that's really arising out of that place, as opposed to that short circuits that's in, oh, let's do this or let's do that or the other, and that's difficult. It's difficult to kind of, particularly in a world that's very fast and very immediate and very geared to, oh, well, how do we sell this quickly? You know, it's...
The weird thing about that The Only Way Is Essex, not what I've seen of it, is that they all seem to be looking for relationship and looking for their individual path in life. Acceptance for who they are, for who they are as an individual. It seems to be that's what they're looking for.
Mm.
And a lot of it's about them sort of like having relationships, cheating on people, getting back to somebody else. It's about this kind of weird interaction. And sometimes, the times when I've watched it, I've been kind of like, wait, but that person's almost exactly the same as that person that you cheated on for. So why would you, they're the same.
Yeah,
it's almost like the same blueprint, but underneath it all, they're actually looking
yes
for their individuality.
Well, but I think that's a really good example of what is true in human beings. I think that we are looking, you know, because actually everybody deep down has this core connection to the divine, core connection to creativity, which gets hijacked in all kinds of different ways. So certainly there's, I can well imagine that there's people that they are searching for something, but they become very disconnected from the actual experience of doing it. And so they're looking, you know, so this whole thing that I keep coming back to, but the difference between the icon and the idol is that the, you know, if you like, the icon is really the way in which the anma works. Because what Garner describes in his writing, what Tolkien describes in his description as well, are these living images that appear that don't really make much sense, but somehow have a depth or a mysterious quality within them, and that deconstruct themselves and deconstruct us as we follow them. So as you follow the image of the spiral straight image inside yourselves, it deconstructs, it moves, it shifts, things shift with it, and it takes you into different places. But the thing that we're having to look at all the time, really, and it is why, you know, when we do this work, I'm constantly changing the methods and forms, is that the habit of the mind routinizes things. So that icons very easily turn into idols. They very easily close off. This is why we keep shifting all the time, looking at things from different angles, and that book, this book, internal experience, music, whatever, constantly working on the, which I know is more difficult to assimilate because it's not as easy for the conscious mind to grasp. But because it's, you know, what we're trying to do here is really not to acquire knowledge, but to understand and embrace the relationship between Anokhi and Anma, in a way. Between being and the expression of being. And even the word like Anma, even the word like Anokhi become problematic once they're too well known, because we think, oh, I know that. And so then we have to think, oh, let's drop those words, or we'll use the different words. So there's a continual process of coming into prayer. I mean, the key thing about work that we do, by all the exercises we do, is just noticing our bodies. And then from our bodies, noticing the world around us. Because the body lives in present time. Now we can not listen to our bodies, we can not listen to our senses, we can wrap ourselves up in our minds. But once we start to notice what our bodies are doing, we automatically start to come into present time, present sense, and come into relationship. We start immediately to notice the I am-ness that is us. And we notice our connections to things around us. Now this is why the Buddha so much stressed body-based meditation. You know, the Satipatthana Sutta, which is the great the Buddha's great instructions on meditation, boil down to notice what your body is doing, notice what your breath is doing. When you're sitting down, notice your body is in the posture of sitting down. When your body is lying down, notice your body is lying down. When your body is standing up, notice your body is standing up. When you're walking, notice your body is walking. Keep doing it. You know, the great realization of the Buddha is in a couple of sentences. From the arising of this, that arises. From the arising of this, that arises. This being, that comes to be. From the ceasing of this, that ceases. This being not, that becomes not. Now there is the whole operation of Anma, where this and that is everything that arises and ceases. And because that's the whole weave of an interaction of our Anma with the Anma of each other, the Anma of the world, that constant process of arising and ceasing that gives the universe and ourselves a constant momentum and change. And therefore, if we want to find stability, we have to find that within change, within movement. Make peace with the nature of things, with the nature of being in relationship. And the great story of the Buddha really is, of course, the great myth of the Buddha is he tries to find perfect peace by getting outside the universe. He goes to all the great meditation masters of his time and acquires extraordinary abilities in concentration and astral travel and appear and concentrating his mind to the minuscule. He lives on a grain of rice a day, so he reduces his body's needs. And there's a marvellous, archetypal moment, not a literal moment, of him sitting down as this skeletal or the burned out figure, where all his methods of trying to escape the world have failed, escape relationship have failed, trying to seek moksha, and then at this moment he's sitting there. And so there's this sort of skeletal recluse. And then this young woman offers him a bowl of rice milk. And this is a great male-female encounter in some ways, where this kind of, where the compassion of the divine feminine meets the fire of intention of the divine masculine. And he's by this point a teacher himself, and he accepts the rice milk from Sujata, the woman. As a result of that, all his disciples run away from him because they feel he's gone soft. He's accepting rice milk from a woman, from a young woman as well. He's really blown all his vows. And then there's this extraordinary moment, creative moment, where he remembers being a small child, being underneath the rose apple tree, which is a tree just that grew near him when he was a very little baby, and being one with the rose apple tree. And he realizes that the way to true peace, to true, is through aware relationship, through being, coming into relationship, coming into union with whatever presents itself. And in a way, that then becomes his foundation of the middle way. So instead of trying to escape or to run away in whatever way, his practice then is to be here. It's a practice of incarnation, a practice of presence. And there's that one, again, it's a great story, the life story of the Buddha. It's full of exciting events, because then he sits down to mature his realization underneath the Bodhi tree, literally underneath the tree of life. And the Bodhi tree is this amazing kind of tree in India. It's sometimes called the tree that walks, because it puts out these amazing kind of roots and it kind of expands around. It's got these beautiful heart-shaped leaves as well, stunning. And so he sits to mature and the devil figure, who is Mara in Indian tradition, comes to get him to gets him to try and change his position by tempting him to lose his own truth and to engage in sexuality or power or riches or to get him away from that center point where he's sitting, knowing the truth of the middle way, which is his own truth. This is the truth that he has discovered. And he sits all the way through the night, 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 as he sits with this practice of the middle way. And then there's this beautiful moment when the first star appears, the morning star, Venus, the morning star appears.
And it's that moment he realizes this truth from the arising of this, that arises, this being, that comes to be, etc. So he's had that kind of insight into the path, and then he has to sit maturing that path inside himself, trusting, if you like, his own Anoki, his own Anwa, and not altering from that position until that understanding has matured in him in such a way that then he can rise and follow where that path takes him. He's not done yet in that place, he's still got more to learn. Because the first thing that happens to him is he encounters a Brahmin and he is this radiant, peaceful being, because he's been through this enormous alchemical kind of process. And the Brahmin comes to him and says, "Why, gosh, who is your teacher? You must have this most amazing teacher, recluse, because you have this great air of peace and love and kindness about you." And his response to the Brahmin, he says, I have no teacher, I alone am the self-enlightenment. This is called his lion's roar discourse, where he's just speaking truth. This is what I have discovered. No teacher taught me this, but I have discovered this through my own search, my own understanding. But he's not sufficiently attuned to the person he's talking to. So the guy goes, "Oh yeah, sure, mate. Okay, thanks very much. All enlightenment, great, excellent, be well," and then passes on. And then he has to think, "That didn't really work." So his Anwa hadn't sufficiently been attuned to the person he was talking to. So by the time he walks and contemplating. And the first thing contemplation he has, "Oh well, no one's going to get it at all." In that case, that was a complete failure. I've just shown my truth. Or maybe people are just going to discover this on their own. And as he's about to decide that and just to go off into the jungle and be on his own, a Brahma god appears and who begs him, for the sake of those who have a little dust in their eyes, to turn the wheel of the Dharma. And in a way, that is the creativity of the universe. And he's thinking, okay, well, I'll just sit and be kind to the universe. I won't teach, because maybe that's not my way. The universe responds back in the form of the Brahma god that says, yes, many won't get it, but those who have a little dust in their eye will get it, if you approach them in the right way. And so by the time he then listens to the Brahma god and responds to that, and by the time he reaches the deer park, he's formulated the Four Noble Truths, which is the truth of suffering and the release of suffering, and the path that leads to the release of suffering, which is the foundation of all of Buddhism. Now that literally comes out of his following of his own being kind of nature, him having and learning to mature his insight in that way. And that's the same process you find Tolkien following, the same process you find Alan Garner following in their different ways. Such were vividly explained in Garner, I think, than in Tolkien, that involvement of the body. When you find Garner wrapping himself up and sitting by the fire and kind of listening to the image and becoming really stupid and kind of, you know, you find it more in Tolkien, where he writes Leaf by Niggle, where he talks about the way this is a story, right, called Leaf by Niggle, whereas he describes in a way the confusion of his mind and his inability to produce the great tree that he's trying to draw, but he does produce one perfect leaf. In a way, that's a point where you see Tolkien kind of elusively indicating something of his own process. Garner shows us his process much more. And the Buddha, when you get past all the mythical things, shows us, okay, this is the way. Pay attention to your body. Pay attention to your breath. But also, pay attention to the world around you. Because actually that whole process that happens with the Buddha, with the encounter with the young woman with the rice milk, with the remembrance of looking at the encounter with the tree, with then sitting underneath the tree, and when he's kind of tempted, and what he has to keep saying and knowing himself, not chasing off the things that are assaulting him, but I know you, which means I come into relationship with you. I know you anger, I know you fear, I know you lust, I know you despair, I know you. But you remain connected to the root place of your own being, and the directionality of your own energy, your own creativity, and the response of the world to that. And that's why whatever we do here, the most fundamental practice and where we always begin with, pay attention to your body. Pay attention to your breath. Pay attention to the directions of space. Pay attention to what's outside. Inside, outside. What is the dialogue? What is the conversation? Trust the conversation. Notice when we're too far out. But also notice when we're too far in. Keep finding that razor edge middle ground where we're connected inwardly and outwardly and in the conversation.
Notice when the conversation is creative and when it's not.
Yes.
Like notice when the conversation
yes.
has become destructive or entrenched into a pattern.
Yeah. Well, balance is the key point, right? Because it's a conversation is creative, is destructive.
Mm.
That in-out balance will be lost. In one way or another. It becomes the spinning, but the spinning wheel is repetitious. That's why that spinning wheel in the lower part of the tree of Hod and Netzach and Yesod, which is the thoughts, the feelings and the energy, routinized images that can just churn forever. Once you notice that, then you step away from it. Come back into the direct sense of Malchut, the direct sense of body. And that we will start automatically to slow down. The presence of Tiferet will start to descend into the mind, into the feelings, and into the pool of subjectivity that is Yesod.
I've got stuck with, where is it, East of East, or whatever it is, the television programme you've got caught with, in interest. And how they all look the same, but they're all trying to find their individuality
yeah.
and their own uniqueness. And I don't know why this is so pushing up in me, so that's why I'm speaking. Do you know how painful it is to be creative? You do, because you had a whole month or two trying to find the solution to your book in the summer, for instance. Or Alan Garner's 10 years of waiting. Buddha with his how many years was he in the forest
yeah.
doing what? It's actually a really big deal to be really creative. And somewhere I'm wondering, I don't know what this is important to say for me, but I can see that if you're East of East, whatever it is, it's an easier route, the less painful route. I don't know why I'm telling you this. I can't see the sense of it, but somewhere it's burning me. That's just being my
guess. I wonder if it is less painful than in some ways. Because what we're talking about, when I talk about being creative, I'm not really talking about books or anything, or product or anything like that. I'm talking about our connection to ourselves. And our connection to our... it is true, it is hard. It takes work, it takes effort, it's not easy. And of course it does place you in a position of being outside community sometimes. You know, so that is absolutely painful. I do agree. You know, but I think if I honestly, I don't know these people. I don't even watch the programs. I don't know what I'm talking about, really, to be honest. But you know, the place. I'm going to have to watch the program now. You know, I've gone on about it so much. I need to find out about it. But the
the idea that where you keep the painfulness of completely repeating yourself without awareness, you know, I think has it, of course, has its own pain, has its own kind of. I think pain. I mean, of course, this is actually that's the whole point of the Buddha's teaching is that life is painful, dukkha. First of his noble truth is life is suffering, but his idea of suffering is that so life, because life is changing, there is a constant process of loss and gain, and the extent to which we resist that is how we create dukkha, which is the resistance to life. And so I suppose that's unavoidable. I suppose what I think wonders, I just think of those, you know, young, beautiful looking people on that program. Well, what happens to them when they're 70? Mm. You know, it's sort of.
I don't know yet, because they've gone so much.
Well, I know they don't know, but they will become 70 at some point. Their bodies will start to fail. And then how prepared are they for that? What are their resources? I don't know, I can't judge them, I don't know their lives. But I guess, and maybe it's probably even unfair of me to use them as an example, but it's because I really don't know them. But I think that you're right, Kosandi, to point out that to be yourself in the world is painful, creates a vulnerability, creates a sense of being different. And certainly the people can turn on you if they think you're different and think that you know, and that's why accusations of being too sensitive, too emotional in British culture can go very strongly. I always want to drop people into somewhere like Latin America or downtown Tel Aviv, and people say shit like this, really. I think people are too emotional.
Canada.
You know, I immediately think of taxi drives I've had into kind of, me and the taxi driver screaming at each other because we can't, because he's not taking me where I want to go, and he's not understanding me, and then by the end of the journey we're shaking hands and I'm giving him a tip, you know, and we're both feeling good,
empty for not engaging with this search for the authentic presence and creativity is being on the roller coaster of constantly looking outwards and everything being externalized and being a constant consumer, which you will notice when you see The Only Way Is Essex. You know, it is thin and outside based. You know, that's the conversation. That's the important thing, the latest thing, always. Because it's better to be isolated and know that you're enough, really, isn't it?
Yeah, but it depends when it happens, I think. Because if you're young, it's happened to me, and it seems wrong, and you haven't got a connection, it's almost like you have to abandon yourself for a connection to survive. And I think if that happens young, you can't survive without other people looking after you, in a way.
How young are we talking about? What do you
mean? I don't know. But it's just a loose thing that how connected I was to my imagination and this other world, which it's not a concrete thing, but I know definitely my brother was just like... So, I don't know, he would not be accepted for who I was.
Well, your brother didn't have the same feeling for you, no.
Not in touch with imagination and creativity. Yeah. We're complete opposite.
That's interesting. Yeah.
So, I don't know, and this judgment, and he always had a problem with me anyway, and this kind of jealousy, and he was older and bigger and physical. So to survive, you have to give that up, in a way. I think it's...
No, it's very complicated, isn't it? Because we live, we do live in a society that really discourages this and such. And I think that's.
It takes huge courage and that courage to like tend to yourself. You have to have a place of self-worth. And for so many young people, that self-worth, I don't know the right words, but having heard you talking of like the dibbuk or the egregore, like that only group, that only way is Essex and all of the young people that they affect, not just in Essex. Like there is such a strong spirit of belonging in that.
Mm.
Yeah, it's interesting to have conversations with my 20-something-year-old daughter who just feels such compassion for, I might take the piss out of someone with Botox. It's so, they can't even form their words properly. Mm. And she'll just really stop me and say, like, that's based on an utter lack of belonging. So the belonging then has to come from, and what that beautiful young woman, even before in work, like when she looks in the mirror, the utter devastation or lack of self-worth that then creates the desire for all of the work. And so there's something like the spirit of that is so strong that then seeing Only Rise Essex, which is kind of an extreme example of what so many young and not so young cultures are experiencing, then it's really, and the desacralization of life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if you get a connection to something bigger, you've got to feel connected to something.
I think that's right. I mean, I think that whole idea of the desacralization of things, I think, is a big thing in that sense. If you don't have access to the stories, the teachings, the ideas that enable you to find a bigger sense of self, then there's a real cultural impoverishment that's happening in our society at the moment.
It comes really of being a colonial power, doesn't it, really? Because everything, I mean, it seems to me with the Industrial Revolution, life became shit for most of the people. We've got bad factories and all this sort of thing, and a completely different form of poverty to the rural poverty that's gone before.
Mm.
But becoming an empire meant everything had to serve that idea of empire, including young people having to be trained to be, like the Boy Scouts, to be, citizens of the empire. That's what the public schools were for, it's all a great big training system to mould people into it. That was anti-imagination, really. And so you've got to get hit with a triple whammy when you're a child, because first of all, there's socialising, knocks the imagination out of you or makes you conceal it. And then you get hit by puberty, where everything else is in abeyance, really, while you deal with your hormones and everything like that. And then you've got to find your cultural, your social group, because humans are socialised beings. And most of us, the internet's done, most of us don't live near our best friends, Most of us actually have access to people with the same ideas as us, worldwide now. Whereas, before computers, you were just stuck there by yourself, with your books. That was the only access. Your only companion was your book. It's always in the front of books, every man I will go with you and be your guide. Those every man editions.
Yeah.
And that's the relationship people have with books of ideas, I think.
Then that can be lonely as well.
With
a book
nothing, though, can it?
But it's into this space then that Tolkien appears.
Mm.
And it's why Tolkien's writings, you could think of them really taking off in the, they're around in the 50s and 60s, but they take off in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And they take off in that time where people are trying to find a new way, trying to find a different way.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, so that sense of the power of the imagination, which so he's a real kind of, trailblazer in
Mm. And then people like Alan Garner, I think, come a bit little later than that. But they, so he really does start, not just him, but C.S. Lewis's Narnia is the stories, you know, which are, you know, specifically for children. But that kind of, if you think of that image in the Narnia books, of the child going into the back of the wardrobe and finding the lamp, the wood, the magical wood, and the lamppost, and Mr. Tumulus, the fawn, who is in the back of the... There's something very kind of homely, really, about Narnia, where the, you know, it's where the other world comes right into your own house, you know, and C.S. Lewis, you know, writes these extraordinary series of books, really, about the inner world of Narnia, which is the inner world of the soul. And what we later discover about C.S. Lewis's writing of Narnia is that each one of those books is connected to the planetary spheres and to, therefore, the sephirot of the Tree of Life. Mm. There's a writer called Michael Ward who did an analysis of because one of the things that C.S. Lewis was very concerned about was this idea of a desacralized world and a desacralized cosmos, as opposed to the medieval cosmos with which all its difficulties were seen as being filled with spirit. And so this sense that you have in the medieval cosmos, if you have the sphere of Earth, you have the sphere of the Moon, you have the sphere of Mercury and Venus, you have the sphere of the Sun, you have Mars and Jupiter, you have Saturn, you have the fixed stars, and you have the primum mobile of the domain of God, which is exactly the same image, a spherical image, but the same image as the Tree of Life. Mm. And what we discover is that with the Narnia, we'll talk about this later in the course, that C.S. Lewis organizes the Narnia books around those spheres. So hidden within the Narnia stories is an exploration of the inner cosmos, or an exploration of the Tree of Life, without mentioning anything to do with the Tree of Life.
Which one is the
Magician's
Nephew?
I can't remember, to be honest, because I wasn't imagining I'd talk about this today. So that'll have to come later when it's in the forefront of my mind, otherwise I'm likely to misremember.
But Alan Garner also says underneath every single one of his stories is a myth, isn't there?
Yeah.
A myth or folklore or legend, and you know, a deeper level to it. And
that's what you see. And that's what you see.
J.K. Rowling did the same with her. How's your father?
Alchemy. She was alchemy. As thing. But I think with Garner, of course, you see that if you see the difference between the his first bit of writing, which is pure Enid Blyton, and with no idea where that's going. With Stone of Brithingamen, he begins with the myth, tells us the myth, and then we're introduced to Colin and Susan. But we're also, and this is the beginning of this book, is very important, because we think you're in modern times, and you are in modern times, because the kids are modern, these are the kids in the 60s, but they're being taken into a mythic place by this mythic man called Gautha Mossack, who is in a horse and trap, who's dressed like an 18th century yeoman, and who takes them to Highmost Redmondhay, which is the farmhouse, which has no electricity and has a well for water. So he's subtle, he's very subtle, he's Garner, because you're already in the myth by the time they get off the station. Mm-hmm. But you don't know you are. You just think, oh, well, he's just, you know, they're going off to visit them.
A bit like the wardrobe again, same sort of thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Transition,
a bit more subtle than the wardrobe, because there's no fawns involved. Yeah. But it's very similar territory.
So what does Rowling do? She uses the alchemy as her...
What she did is to use the processes, I can't remember it now.
but uses the seven operations of alchemy as the basic framework for the Harry Potter books.
Seven operations for
alchemy. Yeah, don't ask me what they are right now, because I haven't got them. Yeah, you could do them good. If I can.
Albino.
I can't remember the order, sometimes it's different. Well, it's different, of course, whichever alchemist you're looking at, but basically, alchemy has seven fundamental. Well, no, that's not entirely true. Sometimes they're eight, sometimes they're 12. She uses seven processes that are the underneath structure of the Harry Potter books, basically.
Is that one in each book, though, or are they just interwoven throughout the whole thing?
I honestly can't remember, to be honest, because I'm not, it's a long time since I've read the Harry Potter books.
There are clues in the names, aren't there, of all the principal characters?
Yeah, the first one's the Philosopher's Stone, and she mentions Nicholas Flamel in it.
Yes, she does, of course, that's specifically. So you do get actual alchemical things. Albus Dumbledore, Albus, I think, is to do with Albedo, which is the white work. Rubius Hagrid, that's it. Refers to the red work, so there's lots of alchemical hints and Sirius Black, who refers to the black work of the Negredo, so there's lots of alchemical allusions within the work, really. There are books you can buy that go into all of that if you want to look into the whole of the Harry Potter thing, but it's
a lot from Tolkien as well. And
yes, she did. That's true. Yeah. One of the interesting things, I'm just going to close. I'm going to need a cup of tea. I'm going to be all gasping. The thing that's really interesting in Tolkien is he makes very sparse use of colour. He makes a lot of use of gold and silver, and light and darkness. And a lot of his work is about the relationship between light and darkness. There's an amazing bit in Lord of the Rings where Gandalf is receiving the light of the sun and holding it in his hand as a sort of a living flame. And in the classic moment where he's fighting the Balrog in the mines of Moria, he announces himself to be a wielder of the fire of Avenor. Now, Avenor is the Tolkien's word for the sun. And the Balrog is the wielder of the flame of Udon, which is the corrupted sun, the black sun. He kind of and that in itself. I'm going to shut up in a moment. We'll never have a cup of tea. But the black sun, which is like the shadow sun, is it was also, given when these things were written, was also an image that was used by the Nazis as one of their core images, that the core energy that they were drawing upon. So there's lots of all these things. There's all kinds of interesting correlations. Anyway, let's just stop and I'll come back.